I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Something happening here in Songspeak from the 60s. In the first summer of Trump, 2017, the something happening feels bigger than the Comey hearings, even than Russiagate. Who knew that a British election with an inconclusive photo finish could rechannel the anger that drives the global mood? The unheralded Jeremy Corbyn at the left end of the Labour Party is the mouse that roared and turned the age of anger in a different direction.
During this amazing 3 months, our party has changed. We've grown enormously. We've grown enormously because of the hopes of so many ordinary people for a different Britain, a better Britain, a more equal Britain, a more decent Britain. They're fed up with the inequality, the injustice, the unnecessary poverty. All those issues have brought people in a spirit of hope and optimism.
Corbyn didn't play the bellowing populist, but he spoke the words. How about a government for the many, not the few? Corbyn asked. And millions of new UK voters said yes. In the face of terrorist outrages in Manchester and then London, just before the voting, Corbyn said, "We must be brave enough to admit the war on terror is simply not working." So it is Jeremy Corbyn's moment to be the standard of unconventional talk that resonates far and wide. Our listening begins with Naomi Klein in Canada. Among book writers on the left, from Michelle Alexander to Bill McKibben to Michael Moore, the line on Naomi Klein is that nobody faster is better and nobody better is faster. Her quick handbook for the Trump era is titled "No is Not Enough." Her line since No Logo in the year 2000 has been that corporate and consumer culture today are hazardous for people and for the planet. Donald Trump is to be seen not as a cause of the problem, but as evidence of it. I asked her this week to take note of that near tie in the UK election.
Well, the way I read that election is that people are ready to vote for something, not just against something. And the real turning point for Jeremy Corbyn was putting out this manifesto that spoke to people's better selves, that had tangible and bold ideas about making people's lives better, like free public education, like tackling student debt, like really funding the NHS, which provides public health care to everyone in Britain but has been systematically underfunded, like getting at the root causes of why we are seeing more and more terrorist threats and the failure of foreign intervention and a very different approach to refugees. It was a generous vision for the many, not the few. And I think that second part is very important because it wasn't just this kind of mushy, we're going to fix everything for everyone. It was also saying, look, we're going to have to go where the money is. We live in a time of unprecedented private wealth. It is stuck at the top. More and more of it is being hoarded at the top every year. And we need a bold political project that is willing to engage in some redistribution of wealth, you know, scary words like that. And it turned out that it was tremendously appealing, particularly to young people who have grown up since the 2008 economic crisis, which is what began the breaking of the spell of the neoliberal project, because we all witnessed that you can intervene in the market to save the rich. And if that's true, well, maybe you can do it for everybody else too.
What are the possibilities for American politics here? Stitch these things together. Where are we going?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at the People's Summit in Chicago, which was a gathering of 4,000 essentially Bernie supporters for the most part. It was organized by a coalition of groups. The anchor of that was National Nurses United, a trade union representing nurses across the country that has been fighting for single payer for many years. And there was definitely a feeling of excitement after having seen what the Corbyn upset in the UK, and a feeling like these ideas are popular and we just need some political mechanism through which to put it on the ballot.
Again, the media doesn't help. The New York Times referred to the Bernie people in Chicago as the militant wing of the Democratic Party rather than, should we say, the rising common sense or something. That spell has got to be broken. The voters don't seem to have a problem. But the conversation still needs a kind of confirmation of these returns.
It is quite extraordinary. And I think that New York Times piece reflected the way a lot of powerful people within the Democratic Party sees the 13 million people who voted for Bernie, which is as interlopers, which is just incredibly unwise when you think about the energy, right? I mean, the biggest problem the Democrats had in 2016 was a failure to energize their base. That's why I think Bernie Sanders is actually absolutely right in saying Trump did not win that election. The Democrats lost it. Imagine dissing that youthful energy, that activist energy at a moment like this, if you were the Democratic Party in as weak a position as they are. It's extraordinary.
Naomi, you speak of a crisis of imagination in our political culture. Cut through it if you can.
This past 40 years, since what we call the neoliberal project began, which accelerated so much under Reagan in this country and Thatcher in the UK, was a set of policies, right? Privatization, deregulation, low taxes paid for with cuts to social services as more and more people were excluded from participating in this economy, there was an explosion of mass incarceration, of criminalization. This is the neoliberal project. But the flip side of it was always to say that, sure, you know, these policies may hurt in the short term or in the medium term or now in the long term, but the alternative to them is apocalypse. And so a huge part of that neoliberal project that we have been living for 40 years has been about constraining the imagination and creating all of these borders around what people will even put on the political table for fear of being condemned as communists or socialists or whatever the smear of the day is. And that is what's falling away. And you see that so clearly in this millennial generation that has been powering the insurgent campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. This is a malleable moment for better and worse, right? Trump is creating a situation because he is himself a system failure. And people are seeing this. They're seeing not just the election of Donald Trump, but that the market cheered on his election, that the media cheered, you know, as he launched missiles on Syria over chocolate cake at Mar-a-Lago. So people are seeing this as a need to get at underlying causes. And we're seeing this in the boldness of the progressive agenda, the willingness to go deep. But at the same time, we have to be cognizant of the fact that these are not the only ideas that are gaining popularity. White supremacy, misogyny, these are surging to the surface. They are playing out on people's bodies and people's lives in blood and violence. So it's really a race against time because that vacuum left by the neoliberal project collapsing, and it has been in a state of collapse since 2008, is allowing other ideas to bubble up to the surface. And some of them are very, very dangerous indeed.
Naomi Klein, you speak very personally about killing the Trump within. Speak about it. What is it we have to purge?
You know, we need to see Trump, I think, as a mirror that's being held up to the world and certainly to this country. He's this kind of dystopian figure. All roads lead to Trump. And he is a product of the culture. None of his products, you know, are made in the USA, but I think Trump is very much a made in the USA character, a product of the culture.
I love the thought that Donald Trump speaks for a culture, even the parts of it that profess to hate him. I was thinking yesterday, who is more deeply invested in the kind of absurd extensions of the luxury real estate market but the New York Times and its Sunday advertising for these panoramic views from the West Side, the East Side, Wall Street? There's a kind of fantasy land that he tempts us all into, whether we like him or not. Now, what sustains the advertising culture is this kind of totally Trumpian fantasy.
The penthouse fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting one because it is a relationship with the world that is entirely apart, right? The looking down upon, separated from community, neighborhood, relationship. And, you know, what worries me most in this moment is this idea that the way to beat Trump is to find one's own liberal billionaire. You know, we need to just sort of draft Oprah, you know, or Mark Zuckerberg. You know, we need a billionaire who cares about climate change and girls' empowerment. And to me, it's really the opposite route that we need to be looking at. Is that is the logic that gave us Trump. And we need to examine the whole way in which politics has been taken over by the logic of corporate branding, which is not something Trump started. Trump was just better at it than anyone else because he is himself a fully commercialized brand. So the table was set for Trump. He just showed up, right, and said, well, I know this game better than you jokers. You know, I'm the real thing. I'm a reality TV star and I'm a mega brand. Step aside, you know? I am not interested in looking at Trump as just like an aberrant personality and all of this psychoanalyzing of him. He is a symptom. I see him as dystopian fiction come to life, you know. I want to look at the roads that led to Trump much more than I want to look at Trump himself. And I want to help people swerve.
Even 6 months down the road of the Trump presidency, you're writing, what has been unsayable can now be said, was said by Jeremy Corbyn, out loud. For example, free college tuition, double the minimum wage, 100% renewable energy as quickly as the technology allows, demilitarize the police, prisons are no place for young people, refugees are welcome here, war makes us all less safe, and as Corbyn said, the war on terror is a failure. How will it happen in the United States?
I'm saying it is happening. You know, it started happening with Bernie's campaign, but it is continuing. The more Trump goes rogue at the federal level and the more the Republicans go rogue, states are stepping up with these bold policies under pressure from below. Look at what happened when Trump announced that he was pulling out of the Paris Accord. Trump said he was elected by the people of Pittsburgh, not the people of Paris. The mayor of Pittsburgh steps forward and says, well, actually, Pittsburgh voted for Hillary Clinton. And as mayor, I'm going to commit this city to get to 100% renewable energy by 2035, which is the boldest target in the entire country. Hmm. And precisely the kind of ambition that we need to see in this country, in countries around the world, if we are going to meet the targets set in the Paris Accord. We weren't doing that, by the way, before. But now, in response to Trump's intransigence and recklessness and destructiveness, the ambition that we need is starting to manifest. We just need to see more of it.
No is not enough is Naomi Klein's new manifesto. Coming up, Prime Minister Theresa May and all the smart money in England thought it was the perfect moment to beef up conservative rule with a snap election. Our guest, David Graeber, saw upset coming a year ago. This is Open Source. David Graeber emerged as something of a cult writer behind the Occupy movement of 6 years ago. He's a Yale-trained cultural anthropologist, meaning in his case, he's a tracker of the invisible stitching around matters of debt and wealth from ancient times. He's prophesied at different times a standard 15-hour work week and the dissolution of the U.S. empire. In the matter of Tory rule in England, David Graeber has been writing since before the Brexit vote about an efflorescence of resistance and a lifting of England's culture of despair.
Well, the key moment is 2010. When the Tories first came in, and most people don't remember this, but they came in alliance with the Lib Dems. And the Lib Dems had actually run on a platform of abolishing tuition fees, which at that point were around £3,000. Tony Blair, the sort of neoliberal Labour Party leader, had brought in tuition fees, and the Lib Dems promised to eliminate them. In fact, they entered into an alliance with the Tories and tripled them and introduced an American-style student loan system. You know, at this point, tuition in the UK is perhaps the highest in the world for some things.
In a country where the intellectual tradition, the university tradition goes way back and it's always been free.
Exactly. And all these people who are doing it had been the beneficiaries of that free education system. This led to a vast student movement. The student movement began with occupations across the country. I don't remember how many there were in all, but there were 35, 40, basically all universities had student occupations. They were quite radical in their demands. They were organized on sort of horizontal anarchistic lines. They all started with the declaration that education is not an economic value. It's not even a political value. It's a value unto itself, and it should be respected as such. And it's not like we have an education system to support the economy. If anything, we have an economy to support the education system, because understanding the world and art and beauty are what we're ultimately trying to organize our lives around in order to put ourselves in a prosperous state to have. So that movement was unsuccessful. They tried to stop the legislation. There were street battles regularly. Crazy stuff was going on. I was witness to, you know, literal cavalry charges against students, battles in front of Parliament, Westminster Abbey. It was incredibly militant. It was incredibly dramatic. And it was almost completely ignored in the international press, but it was one of the things that led to Occupy later on. And in UK, it was very, very important because a lot of the veterans of that, you know, they went into radical media, they went into various forms of organizing, they went to housing organizing, they went into all sorts of different things. I mean, I've actually seen numbers on the number of overall protests, strikes, occupations in the country. And, you know, the last couple years, there's been more than any time since 1972. None of that's been covered. Nobody knows about it because the BBC takes this policy of, you know, just never talking about it. Maybe if somebody breaks something, they'll say only that that happened. But they will not cover demonstrations because the media has basically been completely cowed. It's all done in this covert way where if they come to you and tell you you can't run something on TV, you're also not allowed to say that happened. So there are these covert methods of controlling the media that, especially the BBC, I've had people, I can't mention any names, of course, you know, who are artists, come on to talk about art. And the first thing they're told is like, look, no Tory bashing, you can't say anything bad about the government, who are coming up for funding review.
David Graeber, let me just say, you write about the gap in England between consensus reality, which is to say the chattering class, the newspapers, the BBC, and existing reality, which is to say street wisdom and what anybody knows.
What people say in the pub.
I want to say it's wonderful to hear an American with an anthropological eye, even more anthropological than political, looking at England as a sort of distant early warning of our story. But pick it up at the point where, as you've written, England has been subsisting for years, practically since World War II, on a no future for you premise. Better find another way. And recently in the name of austerity.
Yeah, since the 70s. It's really punk rock that brought it on. I mean, I don't think anybody was saying that in the 60s. And people don't realize that the sort of 60s counterculture, the sort of wild and swinging London of the time was totally a product of the welfare state. All those, you know, all those bands, you know, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, all those guys had been on the dole, had been on relief. I always say in Cockney rhyming slang, the word for dole is rock and roll. You know, oh, he's on the rock and roll again, you know, because they're so identified with each other. There's even bands like UB40. I mean, UB40 is actually the name of the unemployment benefit form. Wow. They were all on relief. Yeah.
But you also speak in the chattering class of a lockstep defiance of reality. How do they get away with it?
I think actually Susan Faludi described this very well in Backlash back in the 90s. She said that people just read each other's stuff. So people who are, you know, journalists and people who are TV producers and people who are movie producers and all these guys, like, their reality is what the other ones are doing. And they can genuinely believe that things are happening or that things are not happening just by listening to each other because they think the other ones are in touch with real people. It's quite remarkable. I mean, one of the most remarkable things I thought, showing just how far gone they are in England, was that David Cameron, the prime minister, who's putting through a lot of the spending cuts, you know, they found his personal diaries, he was actually complaining to his local council about the decline of services. You know, he couldn't believe that his own actions were having the effects that they were.
Amazing.
There's all these people coming up with this sort of imaginary reality whereby it's just cutting the fat and lazy socialism, you know, that all the spending isn't really necessary. And even, you know, the point where he was seeing with his own eyes, you know, his local library closing down and things like that. He couldn't believe it was because of the legislation he just signed in.
But then astonishingly, Jeremy Corbyn comes along and gives people a fairly short list of things they might want.
It's a pretty long list, actually. The manifesto has not been broadly communicated, especially overseas. They had to communicate it in the UK. Basically, what happened with Corbyn? Okay, Corbyn had represented what was considered the lunatic fringe of the Labour Party. There's a handful of 4, 5, 6 people. He didn't even want the job. It's all the other ones had already, you know, gone through the motions of running for Labour leader. In fact, I know someone was in the room. They kind of went around in a circle, and one of them said, well, I had a heart attack. My doctor says I can't do it. And another one, well, I've already tried 3 times. I think I've done my part. Finally, it got to Corbyn, and he's like, okay, it's my turn. He's the most unlikely leader ever. And that's what one of the things people love about him is he doesn't want to actually do this. He's doing this because people want him to do it. It's a sense of responsibility rather than a greed for power. You know, he's just, he sort of reminds everyone of their favorite uncle. You know, he's a sort of nice, kind of whimsical, sweet guy. But he also is great at listening to people.
But then he lays it on the line about let the government run the railroads.
Yeah, and he says, all right, let's just reverse all this stuff. Nobody wants the railroads in private hands. Privatization of the railroads was a disaster. It's a little like healthcare in America. You know, 65% of Americans want single payer, but no politician is for it. Similarly with the railroads. Everybody agrees. I mean, most Tory voters want renationalization of the railroads. But he went on, okay, electric power grid, the water, they privatized the post office. But he also said, let's get rid of zero-hour contracts. Let's get rid of unpaid internships. They're going to ban that. Let's make tuition free, restore stipends. Let's see if we can cancel student loans. This is a real total reversal of Blairism, of this sort of, which is like Clintonism, this kind of corporate market-driven version of supposedly it's somehow left of center politics right. that the Labour Party had previously represented.
And then astonishingly, after two terrorist incidents in Manchester and London during the campaign, he says, by the way, let's get rid of the war on terror.
Yes, that was really an interesting step because, once again, it's something that most people actually agree with. It turns out 75% of Britons do recognize that invading Iraq has something to do with why all this is happening. But he actually had the nerve to say it. He's been saying it all his life. People took him seriously as not just saying something for political reasons. That's the other thing people like about him. The fact that he's been in the wilderness so long means that he actually sticks with his principles. And, oh, I should point out that the British press is way worse than the American in terms of this openness about bias. You know, the British press basically immediately said when this guy became Labour leader, forget it. No, he's way too far out. Someone did a study. There was like basically no positive stories about him. There was only attacks. There was no neutral stories. You know, they would always quote twice as many people against him as for him. So what his party knew is like once the election actually starts, so this is why when there was a snap election, they were for it. Once the election actually starts, there's laws saying they have to give them equal time. So for the first time, people are going to be exposed to what this guy's actually like and what he actually is. Clearly a nice guy, sincere. You know, Theresa May acted like a robot, just reading off the sound bites they'd written for her, never answering a question. He would engage with people. He's nice. And they had to, like, tell the manifesto. And, of course, that was things that most people agreed with. So it was almost like the bursting of a bubble. Everybody was thinking, I can't vote for this guy because nobody else is going to vote for him. As soon as they realized that wasn't true, it just, you know, it cascaded.
Right. But then, David Graeber, and you saw it coming, this so-called, as you said, despair fatigue. Enough of the no future for you. What if we voted common sense?
Yes, exactly. And common sense was one of their big slogans, common decency, common sense. But also, it has to do with the British economy. The British economy is essentially, you know, they say it's a financialized economy. It's driven by the city. And to some degree, that means they're this sort of faithful lieutenant to the American empire. But to largely, it's built on a housing bubble. You know, every rich person in the world feels they have to have a house in London. I mean, there's whole districts of London where, like, you know, there's no lights on at night because it's all like Russian oligarchs or Chinese billionaires who just don't actually live there. They maybe come once a couple of weeks.
To mention Saudis.
Yeah, Saudis, you know, just you name it. Anybody who's rich has to have a place in London. And the question is, why London? Climate kind of bad, right? It rains all the time. It's not that pleasant place. Why not Rio? Why not, you know, there's so many cities they could choose. And the reason why, really, is because it's safe. Essentially, you know, any possibility of a general uprising has been eliminated at least since 1689. You know? There's a happy, subservient working class who will give you anything you want. They really know how to be butlers. They really know how to be nannies. You know, you can get the best servants in the world, and there's no danger of any sort of upheaval, which if you come from Bahrain or Hong Kong or, you know, something could go wrong, but nothing's going to go wrong in London. So the way I put it is, you know, the historical defeat and humiliation of the British working classes is now England's export product. That's why the, you know, the Queen and the nobility is all part of the package. That's what they're selling. All these people want to come to England because that's the land where they really respect their superiors and they can get away with murder and do whatever they like. As a result, you can see there's this resentment of foreigners, but they can't resent the foreigners they actually want to resent because that's where all the money's coming from. It's easy for demagogues of the right to turn that against other foreigners.
So no more despair. Where are we going?
So that's the despair. The question is one of changing that economy to one based on high tech and technology, because, you know, it's one of the most educated countries in the world. It's a place with a long tradition of sort of popular invention. Most inventions in the world in the 19th century were not only from England, they were from, like, you know, rural vicars, and just they really had a tradition of sort of popular science, of popular innovation. And England has never done good for, like, huge corporate complexes and factories. And that's more like an American and German thing. They always went for small-scale cottage industry, like craft-like, even the high-tech stuff. But high-tech is turning that way. So the despair fatigue is largely about, you know, we could make this country into a place like it used to be. I always talk about, like, steampunk. Where did that come from, right? There's a sudden efflorescence of fantasy about Victorian technology. And in a way, it's like the Victorian period is the last period where England seemed like, before everything went wrong with World War One, and, you know, we realized that all this technology was just going to lead to, like, mass carnage and destruction, you know, there's this idea of infinite possibility. So I was like, why is it called steampunk? I can see the steam part, but punk. And it's always like about no future. Punk is about no future. And like they went back to the last moment where there was a future and said, let's just forget everything happened in the 20th century, start over again. And in a way, that's kind of what's happening here.
Oh. People are,
just ditch it. Okay, 20th century is kind of a scratch. On the other hand, we've got a tradition here we can go back to. And that's what Corbyn represents. He's been trying very hard to talk to high-tech industry and saying, no, we're not anti-industry, we're moving back into that sort of thing. And that's why you get all these crazy fantasies. You know, do we want accelerationism? Do we want degrowth? There's all these sort of utopian ideas circulating in Europe, but especially in England. My favorite one is Falck. Do you know about Falck?
No.
Fully automated luxury communism.
David Graeber, there's a way in which Bernie Sanders sort of encouraged the Corbyn uprising. What does Corbyn encourage in American politics?
You know, he's the opposite of Clintonism. He is the person who says, like, they're only going to win by actually being true to your beliefs and providing a real alternative. This sort of triangulation has run its course. In the UK, you could make the argument that Blair just lucked out. You know, it's a strategic misfortune of the left that they ran a hardcore leftist candidate foot in an election that they weren't going to win anyway. And they ran the neoliberal compromising guy in an election they were going to win no matter who they ran, because everybody was sick of the Tories at that point. So everybody says, oh, no, you can't have a left-wing position. Nobody will vote for you. You got to compromise your principles if you're going to get anywhere. And, you know, what we've now discovered is that entire narrative was false. It was never true. That's an enormous difference. And for America and anywhere else, you know, what it means is that you can actually lay out a program which concretely describes a radical alternative to what we have. And even the sort of people that you think of as the swing voters, like a lot of UKIP guys, a lot of people who'd voted for Brexit, turned around and voted for Labour this election. Because it turned out they weren't actually voting against foreigners. They were voting against bureaucrats.
You'll be an American again before we know it. Where do you turn in our country?
Well, I haven't lived here in a while. It's the same sort of thing. The appeal of Sanders was to speak the truth. Now, I should explain. I am not a political party guy. I'm not a member of the Labour Party. I'm not a member of any party in America. I believe in autonomous organizing. The reason I support Corbyn, or I'm happy about him, is because he is willing to work with social movements. And the key thing for the future is to find a way that you can have autonomous social movements that are not in any way dependent on any political party or government. But even more, the people within the system don't try to co-opt them and don't try to just sort of turn them into a extension of themselves. This is what happened to Occupy. And it was largely the Democrats who suppressed us quite violently. So my first thing I would say is Corbyn is a guy who doesn't do that. Corbyn and John McDonnell, his shadow chancellor, is a very important figure here too. You know, he always says, McDonnell says, the way you get social progress, the only way you've ever gotten social progress in this country, speaking of the UK, is by combining parliamentary action, radical trade unionism, and he says insurrection, or as they now politely call it, direct action. You need to have these things, and you need to make sure that the people who are leading the charge within the system are not actually trying to undercut, let alone beat up and jail the people on the bottom. But the right wing understand this. They understand that, like, if you sell out your radicals on existential issues, you know, they're not there, so you can't sell them out on policy issues. The right wing embraces their radicals, whereas, you know, everybody in America thinks in order to be any way successful on the left, you have to completely disavow your radicals. Well, you know, this is showing that's not the case.
Meantime, the signal here as there is sort of back to utopia.
Yeah.
Give us a couple of utopias to think about.
Well, Well, I think I've already mentioned some. There's the degrowth utopias. Let's go back to simple living. Examine how much consumerism is necessary. There's fully automated luxury communism. Let's move technologically towards like 3D printing and making as many things free and available to everyone. But there's also a basic income, a rising idea across Europe. It's sort of developing in fits and starts. But you know, we have a situation where I believe 37% in the UK, 40% in Holland. People think that if their jobs didn't exist, it would make no difference. They're not doing anything. You know, much of what we have is this work machine because we have this idea that nobody deserves the means to life if they don't have a job and aren't working harder than they want to be working at something they don't enjoy. It doesn't matter if it actually does anything. It's somehow we're just creating jobs for the sake of it. We could get rid of that and have people work half the amount they are if we redistribute the jobs rationally. Then you talk about robotization, it would be a lot less than that. So then the question is, like, what is rational redistribution? The very, very simplest approach is simply give people the money. We could just start by saying, all right, everybody gets $40,000, $50,000. After that, it's up to you. People will want more. You know, we'd have to have rent control and some certain other things to make sure that landlords don't grab it all. And the nice thing about that is it would be a left-wing anti-bureaucratic policy. The left really needs to own the anti-bureaucracy, which the right claims to be anti-bureaucracy, but in fact, neoliberal policies just create more and more and more bureaucracy more than the world has ever seen. So we need to get rid of those bureaucrats. And if 40% of the people already believe that their jobs are useless, if we just give everybody money and say, decide for yourself how you want to contribute to society, how can they come up with a worse arrangement than we already have? You know, a lot of people would do bad poetry or form bad bands, but some of them would do good poetry or form good bands. And it's a lot better than what we got now.
David Graeber writes regularly in the Baffler magazine. He spoke with us this week over a Skype line from a vacation stop in Canada. Coming up, Pankaj Mishra's Age of Anger. This is Open Source. The Indian-born writer Pankaj Mishra, now London-based and widely published in the most respected British and American press, is acutely aware that he embodies a contradiction. His argument in his contentious new book, Age of Anger, is that the European Enlightenment from the 18th century, then modernity itself, and globalization today have all been critical to his success, and at the same time, they've been fraudulent promises and an endless provocation to the great mass of mankind, and they still are. He spoke with us this week from London.
The important thing right now is that we see disaffection, militant disaffection often, with the promises of modernity, whether it's equality, prosperity, liberty, in the very heart of the modern world. And I'm talking here of Britain and the United States, two countries that practically invented global capitalism, right now in deep trouble politically, also economically. Large numbers of citizens in these two countries feel left behind, cheated, lied to, deceived. What we are seeing today, after several years of rage being channeled by right-wing demagogues, political movements, we are now seeing the left finally emerge after breaking off its own sort of shackles, its own loyalties to a highly inequitous economic project, and finally assuming a kind of progressive stance. The anger and disaffection that I'm talking about is something that people in Asia and Africa have been experiencing for a long time. For many of them, these promises of modernity have proved to be utterly false and deceptive. And that rage has manifested itself in all kinds of political movements, including movements that are described as fundamentalist or religiously motivated. But they all have emerged from an experience of essentially deception, that so much that was promised to us, whether it's stability, security, prosperity, solidarity, that these were simply lies told to us by a tiny minority, the ruling classes in our countries, who claim to be modernizing our respective nation states, who claim to be leading us to convergence with the modern West. And it turned out that this elite was really largely interested, if not exclusively interested in feathering its own nest, in essentially expanding its own power and wealth. And that feeling of being cheated, of being humiliated, of being scorned, of being taken for granted in Asia and Africa has sort of erupted in all kinds of political movements. And for a long time, people in the West would dismiss them as problems peculiar to backward peoples, to religious peoples, to people who cannot really cope with modernity, who cannot accommodate themselves to the values of modernity, to Western values. And I think now with the eruption of political disaffection and rage in the very heart of the modern West, we are finally learning to analyze this correctly.
What's the common strand here? Michael Ignatieff's big objection to your book was that there's no convergence here between the thinking of disaffected Muslims in the Middle East and unemployed auto workers in the American Rust Belt.
There need not be any convergence. People can feel political rage and disaffection. They can feel marginalized, excluded, in all kinds of national circumstances and indeed economic circumstances. They can do so in an authoritarian state like China. They can also do it in a democracy like India and the United States. That does not mean that their rage is exactly the same. That is not the argument.
Interesting.
The argument is that people are responding to certain factors in their particular societies. And those factors for at least the last three decades have been the failed deceptive promises of global capitalism. The promises of prosperity, the promises of equality, the promise that a rising tide of globalization will lift all boats. You only have to educate yourself in a particular way. You only have to acquire these skills and go to a certain kind of school or college. And you will also make it. And that promise has proved to be a huge deception for large numbers of people.
There's a history here. You take it back to Rousseau. I'm especially interested in the scene that you draw of Dostoevsky at the Crystal Palace in London, 1851, if I got it right. The first World's Fair, showcase of Western technology, consumption. And he went back and wrote Notes from the Underground. This is impossible, he said. This is a threat.
Well, you know, what he was confronting in London in the mid-19th century is a carnival of materialism, which is deeply, deeply seductive. And he acknowledges its seductiveness and says that, look, this is something that people around the world will not be able to resist. This promise of material prosperity, of endless expansion, of technological advancement, continuous progress. But at the same time, he's extremely aware that the promise of that materialism being extended around the world is largely false. It's hollow, and that it will leave many people extremely dissatisfied. And even for people who manage to fulfill that particular promise, they will still not be able to enjoy it to the extent they might think. So there are different kinds of dissatisfactions he's outlining, and he's also pushing back against a extremely simple-minded notion of the individual, of the individual human being, someone who pursues his or her self-interest, and thereby in that pursuit manages to also contribute to the society at large. I mean, Dostoevsky is simply mocking this notion, which is, by the mid-19th century, becoming the dominant ideological notion. And he's basically saying, look, this notion of individual self-interest is extremely, deeply flawed. So we are looking all through the 19th century at a very systematic critique of a modern civilization whose benefits can only be enjoyed by a small minority. Now, in our own time, we've seen the promise of the modern world being globalized, being generalized.
Yes.
There's no part of the world that is now immune to the notion that one must be modern, one must advance in a certain way, one must have an economy that's industrialized, that's part of international trade, and one must have these amenities, these gadgets that will make life fulfilling for all of us. The fantasies of living in a house with a garage for two cars. You travel across India today and you see billboards everywhere advertising that idea of the good life. So there's no part of the world that is immune to that particular promise of industrialization, consumerism, urbanization. And yet we know that there are very severe restraints on that. First of all, very serious environmental restraints on that, not to mention any number of political risks involved in trying to live like a tiny minority in one part of the world, which we already saw in the late 19th century, early 20th century, with the attempts of countries like Germany and Japan to catch up with the advanced West. And we are now confronting similar dangers geopolitically with the rise of China, with the assertiveness of countries like India, who also want to modernize themselves, become strong powers, have a seat, if not actually dominate the international table. So all these kinds of fantasies and pathologies that we saw in the late 19th century and, of course, the early 20th century, they are still with us. They have not disappeared.
I got to push back on two points. You say the premise of the liberal world order is shattered. What account do we have to take of big gains just in the last 10 years against mass starvation, mass poverty of the most extreme kind, for example?
Who wants to credit the liberal world order for that? The biggest advances in eradicating poverty were made in China, which is a state committed to state capitalism for the most part. It has no truck with the liberal order. So I'm not quite sure when people make that argument that neoliberalism is responsible for lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. You really want to ask, where exactly were these hundreds of millions of people lifted? We know that it's China that accounts for the largest number of people being lifted out of poverty. And if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, the picture is very different. If you look at India, there are a whole lot of reasons and factors that have been in play for decades previously, right from the start, right from the time that India was independent. So this claim itself is a highly, objectionable ideological claim that the liberal order is responsible for essentially eradicating poverty.
There's still the question, though, who's to save the baby from the bathwater here, in the sense of all the other fruits of the Enlightenment and reason and medicine and science and transportation and civilized leisure, as a lot of us are privileged to enjoy it.
But who's throwing the baby out with the bathwater? I think these arguments tend to collapse into these very simple-minded binary oppositions that if you're critiquing the liberal order, then you must also be against modern civilization. Now, when we are talking about the liberal order here, we are talking about a certain claim. We're talking about a certain ideology. We are not against all these things that you've just mentioned. It would be utterly ridiculous, puerile, to make a claim that we do not need these boons, these gifts of modern science or modern reason. It's only religious fundamentalists who make that kind of claim. When we are critiquing the liberal order, we are essentially critiquing a claim that there is such a thing as liberal order, that there is such a thing as the liberal order bringing hundreds of millions out of poverty. We are saying that these claims are false, that these claims are advanced by certain self-interested people, and that those claims should be investigated. And they are being investigated right now as we speak.
You're tough, and you should be, on the Enlightenment. But where do we look for the humanistic and artistic treasures of human civilization now?
Chris, that question assumes that had it not been for the Enlightenment, humanity would never have developed any kind of feelings of compassion or sympathy for other human beings, that there are no livable traditions apart from those generated by the Enlightenment. If you don't mind my saying so, that is a highly Eurocentric point of view that completely ignores the long history of human societies.
The utopias of the 18th, 19th centuries are crashing all around us. Is it possibly time for a new utopia? Can you imagine a more nearly open global exchange of serious ideas?
We don't have to imagine a utopia. We can see people all around us at this point struggling for justice, struggling against violence and oppression, struggling to limit the damage being caused to the planet. Many of these, in fact, I find an overwhelming majority of the people who are engaged in these tasks are young people. And it's up to these young people to create a world that will be inhabitable for future generations. Mm. This is a task that every generation has to embrace. Many generations sometimes are too complacent, too lazy. And I would dare say my generation has not been particularly assiduous. The older generation, Tony Jode used to call his generation the crappy generation, the generation of people like Tony Blair and George Bush.
The last decades, yeah.
Absolutely, a kind of intellectually lightweight, historically weightless. The younger generation today, the people who are behind the success of someone like Jeremy Corbyn, people in their 20s and 30s, or indeed Bernie Sanders in the United States, they are awakening to a great mess that we have created. And they are responding to it right now with very different ideas. Their minds are free of prejudices. Their minds are relatively free of ideologies of the recent past. And they are the ones who are going to decide what sort of world we are going to be inhabiting in the next few decades. So stepping away from talk of utopia or speculation about what it should be, I think what's important right now is something that young people are doing. And we see a whole lot of energy and dynamism right now, which can be, by responsible politicians, channeled brilliantly into political movements, into resistance movements. You know, rather than imagining or fantasizing about utopia, let's participate in this resistance to violence and oppression and injustice.
You mentioned your generation. I just wonder if you'd reintroduce yourself east and west. You're a child of almost rural northern India, and you're a darling now of the emerging London literary world.
Not quite. Look, I mean, I grew up in India in small towns, and in many ways, I consider myself a beneficiary of global capitalism, of globalization.
Of the Enlightenment, possibly?
Very much so. I'm very much a member of a minority that has benefited from modernity, from embracing modernity, teaching myself the primary language of the modern world, learning to write in it. This is a success story. But can I say honestly that people from my background in India or indeed elsewhere can replicate this particular journey? The answer is no. I've come of age during a time when this particular ideology was being spread around the world. And I could immediately see that it was profoundly deceptive, that it would generate a whole lot of false promises. I did not know that Americans themselves would start to turn against this false and deceptive ideology. This is something that I had not imagined happening. But in countries like India, in countries like Indonesia, places with large populations, with large numbers of very young people, this is the fantasy that has been offered to them, that individual ambition, energy, entrepreneurial skills, this will bring them the bonanza of the modern world. Of course, it does for some of them, but not for the vast majority.
Pankaj Mishra, wonderful challenge and pleasure to hear you on our program. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
He last interviewed Pankaj Mishra in 2012 on his book titled From the Ruins of Empire. The sequel this year is Age of Anger. Thank you, David Graeber and Naomi Klein. Her new title out this week is No Is Not Enough. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio, all of whom manage their anger admirably. Susan Coyne does our amazing illustrations. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.